Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the November 10th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we'll be reading the following main articles. Colorado COVID-19 Surge, Crisis Standards for Hospitals Reactivated, by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. Education, Staffing Issues Disrupt Classes, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Pfizer asks FDA to expand booster eligibility to all adults, by Sharon Lafreniere, the New York Times Company. Colorado COVID-19 Surge, Crisis Standards for Hospitals Reactivated. Public health officials declare the entire state a high-risk environment, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. Colorado health officials reinstated crisis standards of care for hospital staffing Tuesday amid a surge in new COVID-19 infections in patients, a day after declaring the entire state at high risk from the virus. The crisis standards, previously activated from April 20, 2020 to February 2021, give hospitals and other providers a framework for stretching limited personnel, including how and when National Guard troops and even family members and volunteers can be used to free up medical staff. They also provide legal cover if the care that hospitals can provide under this crisis standards isn't what usually would be acceptable. On Monday night, Colorado health officials declared the entire state a high-risk environment for COVID-19, saying all vaccinated adults now qualify for booster shots once enough time has elapsed since their original inoculation. More than one-third of hospitals reporting to the state said they expected a shortage of intensive care beds in the next week, and nearly 2 in 5 said they would be short on staff. The situation showed no sign of improving Tuesday afternoon when 1,426 people were hospitalized statewide with confirmed COVID-19, a level not seen since mid-December. Teams with the Federal Emergency Management Agency began arriving in Colorado over the weekend to help overstretched health facilities. Parkview Medical Center in Pueblo confirmed that a team of 15, which includes a doctor and a respiratory therapist, among others, is helping out in the hospital's general units. The state has crisis standards for multiple areas, including how to stretch supplies of personal protective equipment and how to ration care by deciding who gets a medical resource, such as a ventilator or a bed in an intensive care unit, if there aren't enough for everyone who needs them. The state only activated crisis standards for staffing Tuesday. Under the staffing crisis standards, hospitals could redirect healthcare workers to help out in strained units with an experienced worker overseeing them. Consider having nurses work longer, ideally less frequent shifts. If possible, have family members or volunteers help patients with hygiene to free up medical staff. Activate the Colorado National Guard for non-clinical jobs such as COVID-19 testing or delivering supplies. Colorado previously had activated crisis standards quite twice during the pandemic, but never the standards related to rationing treatment. At the beginning of the pandemic, Colorado hospitals were allowed to reuse personal protective equipment that was designed to be used only once, but the state deactivated that standard in June 2021 because of improved supplies. From April 2020 to February 2021, crisis standards were in place for hospital staffing and first responders. In the case of first responders, the standards allow them to not take lower risk patients to a hospital and to direct them to other medical resources. Currently, hospitals already have taken some of the steps in the staffing crisis standards without specific authorization. For example, it's become common for an experienced nurse in an intensive care unit to oversee a team of helpers who normally work in other areas. Dr. Eric France, the state's chief medical officer, said in a news release that the goal of activating crisis standards is to allow hospitals to care for more patients safely. We want to be sure Coloradans know they can and should continue to access necessary health care. If you're sick and need care, please go get it, he said. Activating staffing crisis standards of care allows healthcare systems to maximize the care they can provide in their communities with the staff they have available. The state already had taken several steps to try to protect hospital capacity, calling on FEMA for assistance, expanding access to monoclonal antibody treatments, which reduce the risk of hospitalization from the virus, ordering hospitals to take any transferred patients they have the ability to care for, and halting cosmetic surgeries for a month. The only options that officials put on the table and haven't used in this current surge are halting all non-emergency surgeries and allowing hospitals to ration care. Colorado's COVID-19 incident commander, Scott Bookman, has said the state won't consider reinstating a statewide mask mandate or capacity restrictions because the virus situation varies widely from region to region. Expanding booster eligibility. Monday evening, though, the state health department announced in a news release that Colorado is experiencing a statewide surge in COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations, a significant wave of disease spread that makes the whole state a potentially high-risk place to live and work. It wasn't clear whether that represents a policy shift. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention booster shot guidance for recipients of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines identified high-risk settings as one of the qualifying conditions for third doses, but defined them much more narrowly, with only people who live in congregate facilities such as nursing homes or work in places that require extensive interaction with the public making the cut. Jessica Bralish, a spokeswoman for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, said Tuesday that Colorado is in alignment with the CDC because the federal agency's guidance says you can get a booster if you are at high risk because of where you live or work. Because disease spread is so significant across Colorado, all Coloradans age 18 plus qualify for a booster, she said in a statement. With an estimated 1 in 48 Coloradans infected, it is likely that all Coloradans can be exposed to COVID-19 where they live or work. Governor Jared Polis previously has downplayed some of the CDC's more restrictive guidance, including suggesting that older people who wanted extra protection simply claim to have compromised immune systems, which most providers would be unable to verify. And the state has sent text messages to vaccinated Coloradans telling them they are due for booster shots regardless of whether they meet CDC guidance other than the time elapsed since their original immunization. The state health department also called attention to a recent public health order that included a provision forbidding vaccine providers from refusing to give booster shots to anyone 18 and older who says they meet the eligibility criteria and who got their last Pfizer or Moderna shot at least 6 months ago, or their Johnson & Johnson shot at least 2 months ago. Some local departments, including Boulder County Public Health, have adjusted their messaging to emphasize that almost anyone can get a booster shot to help stop the virus's spread. Under the existing CDC guidance, people who had received the Pfizer or Moderna shots and wanted a third dose had to have another qualifying characteristic, such as being over 65, having one or more than a dozen chronic conditions, or living in or working in a high-risk setting. Anyone who got the Johnson & Johnson shot can either get a second J&J dose or switch to one of the other two brands for a booster. Pfizer on Tuesday asked the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to expand eligibility for booster shots to all adults. The FDA would have to agree to expand the shot's authorization, and the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, would make the final call on the country's booster policy. The Biden administration had called for boosters for everyone over the summer, but it backed off after experts pushed back. Now, more scientists are on board as evidence has accumulated that the protection from the vaccines wanes over time and that most people experience about the same side effects as they did from their original shots. Education. Staffing issues disrupt classes. DPS moves three schools to remote learning. Other districts plan to close on Friday. By Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Colorado schools are facing such significant staffing shortages that Denver Public Schools will move three schools to remote learning this week, while another three districts in the metro area are canceling classes altogether. Adams 14 School District, Boulder Valley School District, and Adams 12 five-star schools are closing schools on Friday because they cannot find enough substitute teachers and other staff. Schools in those districts will also close on Thursday for Veterans Day. We are doing everything in our power to keep our schools open and to maximize in-person learning opportunities for our students, said Will Jones, spokesman for DPS, in an email. At the same time, we are facing a critical staffing shortage, like districts across the country, that impacts our ability to safely operate our schools. In Denver, George Washington High School will move classes online starting on Wednesday. The school will remain in remote learning at least until Friday, although online classes could be extended through November 19th, according to a letter to parents. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Early College and John H. Ames Elementary School will go remote on Thursday and Friday, Jones said. School districts have faced a number of challenges in returning to school during the coronavirus pandemic, including a shortage of substitutes, school nurses, and bus drivers. Schools also face supply chain disruption, leading them to reduce food options during lunchtime. The staffing shortages are leading to class cancellations in other parts of the U.S., including Seattle, the Seattle Times reported. DPS has been unable to fill vaccines, and in some cases, employees are on leave to care for family members. Staff members are also becoming sick. DPS is working with schools to determine whether they can safely operate, and when they are unable to do so, they are moved to remote learning, with DPS aiming to notify families by 4 p.m. the day before, Jones said. We are taking this day by day and doing our best to cover the schools that are in need of additional staffing, he said. Adams 14, which announced its decision on Monday, said it is canceling classes district-wide because of shortages of substitute teachers and of staff in its transportation and nutrition services departments, according to a Facebook post by the district. We apologize for any inconvenience this may cause our families and staff members, the district wrote, adding that the closure will be treated as a snow day. Pfizer asks FDA to expand booster eligibility to all adults. By Sharon Lafreniere, the New York Times Company, Washington. Pfizer and BioNTech asked federal regulators Tuesday to authorize their coronavirus booster shot for those 18 and older, a move that would likely make every adult in America eligible for an extra injection. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to grant the request, perhaps before Thanksgiving and well before Christmas travel and gatherings. The prospect of all 181 million fully vaccinated adults in the nation having access to extra shots is a turnaround from 2 months ago when an expert advisory committee to the FDA overwhelmingly recommended against Pfizer-BioNTech's request to authorize boosters for all adult recipients of that vaccine. At the time, several committee members raised doubts about whether the young, healthy people needed boosters. But the Biden administration has been eager to offer extra shots widely since August, when President Joe Biden announced that the best way to protect ourselves was for every adult to get a booster. Biden initially wanted Americans to start receiving boosters in late September, but the beginning of the campaign was delayed after regulators insisted they needed more time to review safety and efficacy data. Some global public health experts said it would be better to focus on getting initial shots to poorer countries with low vaccination rates than to distribute extra shots here so soon. If regulators approve Pfizer's request, Biden will have made good on his pledge to offer every adult a booster shot, although the choice would be limited to Pfizer's vaccine for many. For now, only those 65 and older adults who were at special risk because of medical conditions or where they work or live can get booster injections if they initially got Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna's vaccine. The FDA authorized boosters for all Johnson & Johnson recipients because that vaccine offers less protection. People are allowed to choose which of the three vaccines they want for the extra shot. Nearly 25 million Americans had gotten boosters so far, including people with immune deficiencies who became eligible in August. That amounts to about 14% of people who have been fully vaccinated, a number that could rise sharply if all other adults become eligible for a Pfizer-BioNTech booster. While the eligibility categories are quite broad, at least 30 to 40% of vaccinated adults are still excluded, according to estimates. Moderna is expected to soon submit its own request for the FDA to broaden eligibility for its booster. Some experts predict that the agency might authorize broader use of Moderna's booster, but exclude young men because of concerns about a rare condition linked to the vaccine that appears to affect them disproportionately. The condition, called myocarditis, is an inflammation of the heart muscle. Some countries in Europe have already authorized booster shots for all adults. Israel is offering them to everyone 12 and older. On Tuesday, Canadian officials authorized a booster dose of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for everyone 18 and older. In the United States, experts have fiercely divided over whether booster shots are necessary for the entire population. Many say the vaccines continue to offer robust protection against severe disease and hospitalization, especially for younger people without underlying medical conditions. This is virtually unanimous agreement that vaccinating the roughly 60 million Americans older than 11 who have yet to receive even their first shot should remain the government's highest priority. For younger, healthy people, the benefits of a booster injection will be marginal, according to Dr. Eric Rubin, member of the FDA's advisory panel and an adjunct professor of immunology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Even so, some leading experts argue that the case for booster shots has grown stronger. Dr. Naheed Badalia, director of Boston University Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases Policy and Research, said there's some stronger data than there was in September when the FDA Advisory Committee rejected Pfizer's initial request. She added, "I think that the boosters now seem to look like they may help severe disease for a lot of people that we thought previously." Rubin said he was reassured by the fact that as Israel began vaccinating younger people, they really weren't seeing any significant safety signals. Earlier this month, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the federal government's top infectious disease expert, said the most recent data from Israel shows that its aggressive booster campaign has limited the rates of severe disease hospitalizations and death there. He called the results rather dramatic. Federal officials have been watching Israel's experience closely because its vaccination campaign took off quickly, starting at the end of July, and it has a nationalized health system that allows outcomes to be more easily monitored than in the United States. An Israel study published in the scientific journal The Lancet in early October compared about 730,000 people who had received a booster dose in August or September with individuals who had received only two doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine at least 5 months earlier. The study included recipients 12 and older. The median age was 52. Compared with the two-dose recipients, the boosted recipients had a 93% lower risk of hospitalization, 92% lower risk of severe disease, and 81% lower risk of death, the study found. The booster recipients were evaluated between 1 week and nearly 2 months after their third dose. Pfizer and BioNTech said that their request is based on data from a clinical trial in the United States and elsewhere that included more than 10,000 volunteers. They said the third injection countered the vaccine's waning potency over time. After the third shot, the vaccine's efficacy rate against symptomatic disease was up to about 95%, they said. The FDA has the authority to modify Pfizer-BioNTech's current emergency use authorization and is not expected to reconvene its advisory panel. Rubin said he was fine with that. The FDA got a good sense of what the panel was concerned about, and they're in a good position to make a judgment themselves now, he said. Moderna could follow with a request much like Pfizer's, but winning authorization may be more complicated because of concerns about rare cases of myocarditis, especially in men under the age of 30 who have received two doses of Moderna's vaccine. Similar concerns have been raised about Pfizer's BioNTech vaccine, but to a lesser extent. If regulators approve Pfizer's request, it will, to some extent, just officially condone what health officials say they already see happening frequently. A move of this sort, if it is supported by the data, which I haven't seen, is a recognition of that reality. Dr. Nirav D. Shah, Maine's top health official and president of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. Provided the data shows that the boost is worth it, this is a good move, he said. Colorado School of Mines. Professor alleges football coach tried to hijack his classroom mid-lecture, by Elizabeth Hernandez, the Denver Post. A Colorado School of Mines professor said the institution's head football coach and associates barged into his classroom in the middle of a lecture last month, harassing the professor and nearly 100 students by blowing a whistle, turning off the projector, and shouting at everyone to get out so the team could use the room. Professor Ning Lu, who has been with the school for nearly 25 years and has expertise in soil and water, described the October 8th incident as an act of workplace violence that left him rattled and sent at least one student into a panic attack. Lou said he immediately reported the incident, but a month later has only been told the university investigation was completed. Seven Mines students also reported the incident, said Emily Roush, a university spokeswoman. She said School of Mines officials investigated and took swift, appropriate action. Providing a safe and supportive environment where Mines students can learn is our number one priority, Roush said. While we cannot confirm the specifics of this incident, Mines does not condone disruptions that impact the educational process in our classrooms. Roush said the school cannot comment on confidential personal matters, but the disciplinary action was taken. Greg Brandon, the School of Mines head football coach, remains in his position, the university confirmed. Brandon did not respond to a request for comment from the Denver Post. Mr. Brandon committed workplace violence in public on October 8th, Lou said. Not only verbal violence, but physical intimidation. Not only targeting the class by himself, but also directing another individual to target me. Not only causing classroom chaos, but leading to multiple people physically and emotionally shaken and causing student panic attack. My class and I have been kept in complete darkness about whether and what the university did to investigate this horrible incident of workplace violence, all under the cover of confidential personal matter, he said. On October 8th, Lou said he and the students in his soil mechanic class, which is taught in a room in the football stadium complex, waited outside the classroom for about 15 minutes because the football team was in the room. This was the third time this semester that my class started late because the football team wanted to use the room, Lou said. The head coach was well aware that it was our scheduled class time, and, in fact, he told me in the weeks before that I should expect to start class late because he wanted to use the room instead. Lou finally entered the room and asked the people inside to leave so we could begin teaching, he said. They left, and Lou said he began his lesson. But, he said, he soon was interrupted by Brandon, who entered the room shouting that he was the head coach and instructing everyone to leave. Nobody left, Lou said, and the class continues. Soon after, Lou said his class was interrupted again by the sharp sounds of a whistle blowing, and Brandon and associates, Lou didn't know whether they were student athletes or Brandon's peers, entered the room. Lou also said he was unsure who blew the whistle. The university said no student athletes were involved in the incident, but did confirm who else accompanied Brandon. One person directly approached me at the podium, shut down my projector, and made moves that suggested he wanted to remove my other things and possibly even me, Lou said. I told him to stop, and the person eventually stopped. Meanwhile, Mr. Brandon was shouting a lot at the students and his team, trying verbally and physically to get students out. Students panicked and some fled the room, Lou said. One student had a panic attack in the hallway, the professor said. Brandon eventually left the room, Lou said, but came back shortly after, asking Lou to write his name down on a piece of paper. I was shaken, Lou said. For the student's sake, I kept my composure and resumed teaching for the fourth time and finished the class. Days after the incident, an HR representative and athletic director, David Hansberg, came to Lou's class to apologize for the events that happened, Lou said. Lou said the university told him they investigated the incident and that appropriate action had been taken but could not be shared. Lou said he and his class deserved to know the outcome of the investigation, and he wanted to know specifically what policy prevented the university from sharing any information about the investigation. He also requested that the university publicly condemn the incident. We are a public university, and this happened in public, Lou said. To me, it's clear they want to sweep this under the rug and that they're covering it up and want this to go away. We value their work. CU Boulder employees will be getting pay raises. 3% raises and 1% bonuses are expected, by Katie Langford, Daily Camera. Most University of Colorado Boulder employees will see a 3% raise, and about 3,000 graduate students will no longer be required to pay $1,500 in annual student fees starting in January. On Friday, CU's Board of Regents unanimously approved pay raises for most employees, and Boulder campus officials announced that graduate students on appointment would no longer be required to pay student fees. CU Boulder and other CU campuses did not meet the enrollment levels necessary to trigger automatic raises this year, which is based on a new compensation model approved by the Board of Regents in April. When we saw that we weren't going to hit the threshold, we knew we needed to intervene and figure something out, said Interim System President Todd Salomon. Faculty and staff have been working incredibly hard and will continue to do so. The cost of living has been going up, and we need to do something to recognize everyone's hard work. The raises apply to non-classified employees because the salaries of classified employees, who saw 3% raises starting in July, are set by state legislature. Employees will also receive a bonus in January equivalent to 1% of their annual salary. Frontline workers will receive a one-time recruitment retention bonus. Lecturers and adjunct instructors will receive a one-time 3% bonus. And graduate students on appointment will receive a 3% stipend increase. I hope it sends a message that we care and we value their work, and we appreciate what they've been going through the last couple of years and the work that they will continue to do over the months to come, Salomon said. The 3% raises and 1% bonuses are expected to cost $29.6 million across the CU system and will be funded through the system office changing the way it charges campuses for services. Chancellor Phil DeStefano said he was grateful to the Board of Regents and Salomon for making the raises possible, and to the faculty and staff who kept the university moving forward over the past 2 years. Our faculty and staff really stepped up, and I'm so appreciative that they were able to reward them with a salary increase, DeStefano said. The raises will apply to about 7,900 employees, DeStefano said, in addition to its 790 classified employees who received raises this summer. Hourly student employees, temporary employees, and those who receive low performance ratings don't qualify, according to CU's website. The elimination of student fees for graduate students on appointment, those who are graduate assistants, teaching assistants, part-time instructors, and research assistants, has been a years-long effort. And DeStefano and graduate school dean Scott Adler said they were thankful for the work of the graduate and professional student government to address fee waivers. The cost of living for our graduate students in the Boulder area is very, very high, and anything we can do to make their lives better, particularly students doing research and teaching appointments, anything we can do to make that cost of living lower and their lives easier is all for the good, Adler said. Another group that has pressed for CU Boulder to eliminate fees for graduate student workers is United Campus Workers Colorado, which has organized a walkout, sit-in, petitions, and other protests in recent years. Doctoral student and UCWC steering committee member Sam Zhang said he was overjoyed by the news. Zhang said he sat in a meeting on Monday during which graduate students talked about how they would use the extra money, like going home to visit family or paying down student loans. This will make enormous difference for the graduate students, he said. We don't expect the administration to acknowledge us. That's not our policy, but it's clear to all graduate students that this is a result of years of hard work from our union. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Boyd Barker, July 2, 1924 to October 15, 2021, research physicist. Daniel Boyd Barker was a Renaissance man, enjoying the challenges both in a technical career and in nurturing his artistic talents. He was a kind, thoughtful, generous man who was open-minded and treated everyone with respect. Boyd was born and raised in Denby, South Dakota. Boyd and his wife Patricia moved to Denver in 1961. They loved living in Colorado. After Pat's passing in 2018, Boyd moved to the Claremont Park Memory Care Facility in Denver, then to Via Capri in Santa Rosa, California, where he lived comfortably until his death at 97. A longer obituary is available at dignitymemorial.com/obituaries/Santa Rosa. There will be a celebration of Boyd's life on Saturday, November 13th at 11 a.m., followed by a reception at First Plymouth Congregational Church, 3501 South Colorado Boulevard, Englewood. Face masks and other COVID protocols will be in place. The service will also be mainstreamed at YouTube/8YQI4XUHZ90. Donations may be made in Boyd's honor to First Plymouth Congregational Church or the Alzheimer's Association. Robert Brasfield, January 9, 1947 to October 23, 2021. Robert B. Brasfield, 74, of Denver, passed away on October 23, 2021. He was born January 1, 1947 in Denver, Colorado, the son of Robert and Verna Brasfield. Robert is survived by son Robert Bobby Brasfield, daughter Sarah Brasfield, granddaughter Abigail Farrow. He is preceded in death by his parents and sister Mary Halderson. George Mavrakis, September 4, 1945 to November 6, 2021. For full obituary and service information, please visit HoranCares.com. Michael D. Groshek, September 23, 1932 to October 23, 2021. Mike Groshek died October 23rd at home, encircled by his loving family. He was born in Flint, Michigan, to Michael J. and Pauline Ignash Groshek. Raised in the heart of Vehicle City, he treasured his Polish roots and traditions. Sports were his passion, football, baseball, and especially basketball. His parents had limited school opportunities, but Mike learned the importance of hard work and value of education. He attended college on a basketball scholarship, graduating from Regis University in Denver in 1953. Drafted into the Army and shipped to Korea, Mike served 9 months and saw the end of the war. He graduated from Georgetown Law School in 1958 on the GI Bill. A blind date with Ann Horbett was followed a year later. By a second date, Mike and Ann were married September 6, 1958. They moved to Denver, where Mike had found work with the law firm now known as Sherman & Howard. He celebrated the job offer by spending his last dime on an egg sandwich. Mike's knowledge of public finance was renowned. Colleagues recall being groschecked, i.e. being kindly and thoroughly corrected when they made an error. Mike retired in 2018 after 60 years with the same firm. For decades, he was known as the man who climbed the stairs, 25-plus flights every morning, to his office. Basketball faded, but tennis became his sport. He prized the friendly competition until age 85. Mike and Ann welcomed four children, Mark, Barbara, Paul, and Mary. Ann chose raising the children over a career, and Mike was also always grateful for this. Adventures abounded, including all four kids simultaneously riding Horsey on Dad's back and an annual two-week camping trips. Who knew Mike and Ann survived in part because of a hidden bottle of bourbon? Later, seven grandchildren came on the scene. Mike deliberately cultivated a special relationship with each one, something they will all cherish. He had a 16th birthday lunch with each, where he depicted the unfolding of a life, his, and how it was guided to success and happiness by love, hard work, and the kindness of others. He had deep pride in his accomplishments, but wielded it with humility and gratitude. We love and miss Mike, Dad, Dizads. He taught us to embrace learning. I read in The Atlantic the other day, to live with humor. He was the prototype dad of dad jokes, to watch and shake our heads over the Broncos. He was endlessly proud of his children and grandchildren, of their uniqueness and achievements. He was an engaging conversationalist, always interested in people's stories and points of view. His memory was uncanny. He was generous. His skill in hiding Easter eggs was unmatched. He loved travel, chocolate mint ice cream, the Churchill Book Club, the Expanders, polka, and classical music, especially opera. We laughed with you, Dizads, and you mentored us. You were a true gentleman. Mike was predeceased by his parents and siblings, Madeline Harahan and Norm Groschek. He is survived by his loving and adventurous wife, Ann Groschek, children Mark Groschek, Carl Clark, Barbara Verste, husband Jeff, Paul Groschek, wife Melissa, and Mary Burns, husband Ken, grandchildren Nathaniel Verste, Cameron Groschek, Georgia Cheshire, husband Alec, Andrew Verste, Julia Burns, William Groschek, and Brett Burns, brother Richard Groschek and sister-in-law Pat Groschek, and nieces, nephews, and their families. Funeral Mass will be held November 15th, 10:30 a.m. at Christ the King Church, 830 Elm Street, Denver. Service will be live-streamed. Link at HoranCares.com. Reception follows, and in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Regis University or Samaritan House. James W. Langley, M.D. Dr. Jim Langley of North Glen. Visitation Thursday, November 11th at 5 p.m. with recitation of rosary at 6:30 p.m. at the Chapel of Ellis Family. Funeral Mass Friday, November 12th at 10 a.m. at St. Joseph Catholic Church, 969 Ulysses Street, Golden. Interment Golden Cemetery. Full obituary at ellisfamilyservices.com. Margia Grisenti Martelon, born 12-19-1934 in Denver, Colorado, died in her home, surrounded by family, on November 1st, 2021. To accommodate most family members, rosary and celebration of life services to be held at a later date. Instead of flowers, please consider donation to the National Jewish Hospital ILD program or Blessed Sacrament Church. Donald Charles Milliman, November 30th, 1926 to October 30th, 2021. Donald Charles Milliman, Don Don, age 94, went to be with his Lord on October 30th, 2021. Don is survived by his loving wife, Wendy, 5 children, 5 grandchildren, and 6 great-grandchildren. Don was born in Cleveland, Ohio. His family moved to Denver in 1935. He graduated from South High School and University of Denver. He spent over 50 years as a dedicated, caring, independent insurance broker and estate planner. Don will be recognized at a Mass of Resurrection at 12 p.m. on Thursday, November 11th at Good Shepherd Catholic Church, 2525 East 7th Avenue Parkway, Denver, Colorado, followed by interment at Fairmount Cemetery and a reception. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Children's Diabetes Foundation, 3025 South Parker Road, Suite 110, Aurora, Colorado, 80014. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. House January 6th panel subpoenas 10 former White House aides by Mary Clark Jelonek, Eric Tucker, and Jill Colvin, the Associated Press. Washington. House investigators issued subpoenas Tuesday to 10 former officials who worked for Donald Trump at the end of his presidency in an effort to find out more about what happened, what the president was doing and saying as his supporters violently stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th in a bid to overturn his defeat. The subpoenas, including demands for documents and testimony from former senior advisor Stephen Miller and former press secretary Kayleigh McEnany, bring the House panel tasked with investigating the insurrection even closer inside Trump's inner circle and closer to Trump himself. They came a day after the committee subpoenaed 6 other associates of the former president who spread mistruths and widespread fraud in the election and strategized about how to thwart President Joe Biden's victory. The select committee wants to learn every detail of what went on in the White House on January 6th and in the days beforehand, said Mississippi Rep. Benny Thompson, the Democratic chairman of the panel. We need to know precisely what role the former president and his aides played in efforts to stop the counting of the electoral votes and if they were in touch with anyone outside the White House attempting to overturn the outcome of the election. It is unclear if the January 6th panel will subpoena Trump, though the committee's leaders have said they haven't ruled anything out. The panel has now issued more than 30 subpoenas, including to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, longtime ally Steve Bannon, and others who were close to the former president. The House later voted to hold Bannon in contempt after he said he would not comply, and the Justice Department is still deciding whether to prosecute the case. Meadows and others have engaged with the committee, according to lawmakers, but may still be held in contempt if they do not fully comply. The panel has already interviewed more than 150 witnesses and lawmakers have said they want to not only probe the attack itself, but its origins, namely the lies that Trump spread about massive voter fraud, even though all 50 states had certified Biden's win and courts across the country rejected his claims. The violent mob of Trump supporters echoed those false claims as they pushed past police, broke through windows and doors, and threatened lawmakers. Trump continued to push the false narrative in a statement responding to subpoenas, saying the committee is studying the protest when it shouldn't be studying the fraudulent election that led to the protest. The 10 former officials who were subpoenaed Tuesday either could not be reached or did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The panel said Tuesday that it had issued subpoenas for Miller, who Thompson said had participated in efforts to spread false information about alleged voter fraud, and McEnany, who the committee said was present at times with Trump as he watched the insurrection and spoke at a rally that morning. Mandate by Congress. New cartet needed to stop drunken driving by Hope Yen and Tom Krischer, the Associated Press. Washington. Congress has created a new requirement for automakers. Find a high-tech way to keep drunken people from driving cars. It's one of the mandates, along with a burst of new spending aimed at improving auto safety amid escalating road fatalities in the $1 trillion infrastructure package that President Joe Biden is expected to sign soon. Under the legislation, monitoring systems to stop intoxicated drivers would roll out in all new vehicles as early as 2026 after the Transportation Department assesses the best form of technology to install in millions of vehicles and automakers are given time to comply. In all, about $17 billion is allotted to road safety programs, the biggest increase in such funding in decades, according to the Eno Center for Transportation. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said that could mean more protected bike paths and greener spaces built into busy roadways. It's monumental, said Alex Otte, national president of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Otte called the package the single most important legislation in the group's history that marks the beginning of the end of drunk driving. It will virtually eliminate the number one killer on America's roads, she said. Last month, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration reported an estimated 20,160 people died in traffic collisions in the first half of 2021, the highest first half total since 2006. The agency has pointed to speeding, impaired driving, and not wearing seatbelts during the coronavirus pandemic as factors behind the spike. Each year, around 10,000 people are killed due to alcohol-related crashes in the U.S., making up nearly 30% of all traffic fatalities, according to NHTSA. Currently, some convicted drunken drivers must use breathalyzer devices attached to an ignition interlock, blowing into a tube and disabling the vehicle if their blood alcohol level is too high. The legislation doesn't specify the technology, only if that it must passively monitor the performance of a driver of a motor vehicle to accurately identify whether that driver may be impaired. Sam Abulismid, principal mobility analyst for Guidehouse Insights, said the most likely system to prevent drunken driving is infrared cameras that monitor driver behavior. That technology is already being installed by automakers such as General Motors, BMW, and Nissan to track driver attentiveness while using partially automated driver assist systems. The cameras may make sure a driver is watching the road and they look for signs of drowsiness, loss of consciousness, or impairment. If signs are spotted, the car will warn the driver, and if the behavior persists, the car would turn on its hazard lights, slow down, and pull to the side of the road. Abulismid said breathalyzers aren't a practical solution because many people would object to being forced to blow into a tube every time they get into a car. I don't think it's going to go over very well with a lot of people, he said. Astroworld lawsuits. Rapper's rowdy past raises red flags. Eight people died at the Travis Scott concert in Houston, by Bernard Condon, the Associated Press. Lawsuits are piling up less than a week after the deadly crowd crush at the Astroworld concert, and legal experts say the risk of liability is mounting for rapper Travis Scott and the companies behind the tragic event in Houston. Several legal experts told the Associated Press that Scott's past incitement of concertgoers offers a history that could make it easier to pursue negligence claims against companies that planned and managed the show, which killed eight people and left hundreds injured. And although the investigations have just begun, experts expect to see dozens more lawsuits seeking damages that could climb into hundreds of millions of dollars. At the center of the legal maelstrom is Scott, a 30-year-old rapper famous for whipping fans into a frenzy who has pleaded guilty to misdemeanor charges tied to stirring up crowds at previous concerts. This tragedy was months, if not years, in the making, wrote Houston lawyer Steve Kecker in a lawsuit demanding more than $1 million for a man trampled in the melee, which he said was predictable and preventable given the rapper's history. More than a dozen lawsuits have been filed so far against Scott and several companies, including entertainment giant Live Nation, concert promoter Scoremore, a nonprofit managing the Houston-owned venue. The complaints allege the organizers failed to take simple crowd control steps to staff properly and to act on early signs of trouble at the sold-out concert at NRG Park that attracted 50,000 fans. Attorneys have seized on an early cue of trouble that came hours before the concert began when throngs of fans rushed past security and metal detectors through a fence. Whatever security they had was wholly insufficient, said former federal prosecutor Philip Hilder, a Houston lawyer not involved in any Astroworld case. The crowd went right through. Several lawyers say litigation is also likely to focus on an unexplained delay between the time city officials declared a mass casualty event and when the concert organizers finally stopped the show, a 37-minute gap during which fans kept pushing towards the stage, collapsing and getting crushed. It's not clear what Scott could see from the stage. Scott is famous for encouraging fans to ignore security and crowd surf and stage dive in the mosh pit below him. Dallas lawyer Ellen Presby said Scott's past will help make a case against him, but his likely defense will be to argue that he is just a performer who leaves the security details to other people, which will make it more difficult to attach blame. GOP congressmen criticized for anime attacking Ocasio-Cortez. Phoenix, Arizona Rep. Paul Gosar was facing criticism after he tweeted a video that included altered animation showing him striking Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with a sword. In a tweet Monday night, Ocasio-Cortez, a Democrat from New York, referred to Gosar as a creepy member I work with and said he shared a fantasy video of him killing me. She added that Gosar would face no consequences because Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy cheers him on with excuses. She also said that institutions don't protect women of color. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tweeted Tuesday, threats of violence against members of Congress and the President of the United States must not be tolerated. She called on McCarthy to condemn this horrific video and call on Ethics Committee and law enforcement to investigate. Spokespersons for McCarthy did not immediately respond to requests for comment on Pelosi's tweet. Gosar, a Republican, posted the video Sunday afternoon with a note saying, Any anime fans out there? Late Tuesday, he issued a statement saying the video wasn't meant to depict harm or violence, calling it instead a symbolic portrayal of a fight over immigration policy. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
November is National Hospice and Palliative Care Month, and advocates are hoping all Coloradans will consider these underutilized healthcare services for themselves and family members. Katie Sue Van Valkenburg with Namaste Home Health says everyone will go through an end-of-life journey, and hospice care, which is available to anyone facing a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, can help families and friends make the most of their remaining time together.
And just like we celebrate babies being born, I want to make sure that we're celebrating people as they leave this life. because hospice is covered by insurance, why not utilize it so you can have a much more enjoyable and comfortable end-of-life experience both for you and for your family?
Palliative care focuses on improving the quality of a patient's life as opposed to curing a specific illness. Hospice teams provide medical care and pain management and give family caregivers a break by helping with showering and other daily activities. They help navigate Medicare and Medicaid paperwork and offer emotional and spiritual support, including 13 months of bereavement services for family members and friends. Most people access hospice through a doctor's referral, but Matt Whitaker with the group Compassion and Choices says you can also find options online. One common misunderstanding about palliative care is that patients are giving up so-called battles with their illness, but Whitaker says many patients continue chemotherapy and other regimens as they struggle with powerful diseases.
And what we have to do is support people as they make the decision to move from focusing on cure to focusing on care, making sure that they're able to spend the days that they have left doing what gives them the most meaning possible.
Van Valkenburg says she's hopeful that Namaste's new operation in Grand County will help more patients stay in their homes. Before Namaste arrived, palliative care had not been available in the area for some 8 months, which is not uncommon in many rural communities.
But most of the time, if they require a nursing home or a secure unit because of advanced dementia, they're being shipped down to Denver, which means they're no longer close to family, which can definitely cause a lot of emotional stress and trauma for everyone involved.
This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. On this Veterans Day, the nation honors those who served in the military, now about 19 million people, including Tim Keefe.
When I swore into the Navy in Boston, I was ready and willing to give my life for this country. And it seemed like during this time, I couldn't even get a sandwich from them.
Keefe testified about his struggles with food insecurity during a House hearing Wednesday. After he suffered a work injury and became homeless, Keefe received food assistance benefits, but was cut off after 3 months when he couldn't meet job requirements.
Unfortunately, I can tell you firsthand that when you have gone a couple days without food, your whole being cries out for it. The desperation I can't explain.
Homelessness is another challenge faced by about 40,000 veterans. CEO of the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans, Catherine Monet, says the Build Back Better plan includes significant investments to address the problem.
When I say significant, I mean truly game-changing, right? $25 billion in rental assistance, $15 billion for the Housing Trust Fund, and $455 million for the Enhanced Use Lease Program.
And during a White House ceremony honoring veteran caregiving families, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said there's a new effort to better support military families in transition.
Our military families make us a stronger, a healthier, and a more ready force. So we have to make sure that our phenomenal military families can not only survive the hard times, but they can actually thrive throughout their service.
President Joe Biden will deliver Veterans Day remarks at Arlington National Cemetery and participate in a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, marking its 100th anniversary. Biden highlighted the recently passed $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, which he'll sign Monday.
This bill is going to reduce the cost of goods to consumers, businesses, and get people back to work, helping us build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out, that where everybody's better off.
Biden expects rising prices to fall once supply bottlenecks ease. U.S. consumer prices rose more than 6% in the past year, the fastest annual pace since 1990. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is considering legal recourse in response to allegations the federal government sent 70 planes carrying migrants from the southern border to Jacksonville this summer. He also threatened to shuttle buses of migrants to President Biden's home state.
I will send them to Delaware and do that. I mean, if he's not going to support the border being secured, then he should be able to have everyone there.
A key source of information for the Steele dossier, Russian policy analyst Igor Danchenko pleaded not guilty to 5 felony false statement charges. He's accused of providing false information to the FBI, investigating ties between Russia and the 2016 Trump presidential campaign. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Caring Senior Service prevents common dementia behaviors and caregiver strategies. Resistance to bathing. Seniors with dementia exhibit behaviors that may seem confusing or inexplicable. However, these behaviors are often overlooked as symptoms of dementia because they vary from person to person. People with dementia can sometimes have difficulty remembering to maintain good hygiene, such as brushing their teeth, toileting, bathing, and changing their clothes. As the caregiver, you should investigate some of the reasons they are resistant and see if you can help. Does the person feel unsafe? Are they able to see and comprehend the depth of the water? Have they been shown the safeguards and grab bars? Is the water too hot or too cold? Are they uncomfortable being in a hospital or getting undressed in front of strangers? Caring Senior Service provides care within an hour. Call them at 1-800-SENIOR-CARE. That is 1-800-736-4672.